Yano Yondo there, performing Beethoven's Polonaise, Opus 89. And Donald MacLeod will be back tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock following the prom with a final instalment of Composer of the Week, looking at the life and music of Beethoven during the years 1820 to 1822. This is BBC Radio 3, a very good evening. It's 7 o'clock and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, James. Hello and welcome to the Albert Hall. It seems incredible we've already reached Prom 16, which means the first visit to the 2012 season for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. The orchestra's outgoing principal conductor, Thierry Fisher, was to have been at the helm, but he's suffering from a dislocated jaw and sadly has had to withdraw from this concert. To replace him, making his debut with this orchestra, we have a multi-talented young musician with a thriving three-pronged career as composer, conductor and pianist, Ryan Wigglesworth.
I think the call came in late Friday afternoon and I got the scores that evening, actually. The only piece I had actually performed before was La Mer, so the rest of it meant quite a chock-a-block weekend. I sat down and thought about it, thought through the programme as much as I could, and then knew that I had to do it.
Ryan Wigglesworth. Well, the programme he's taken over has the sea as a major influence. We spend the second half either on it or beneath it, with two orchestrations of Ravel and Debussy piano pieces before Debussy's magnificent evocation of the ocean, La Mer. And in this celebratory 150th anniversary year of Debussy's birth, we're also celebrating the 80th birthday of a composer who's very much alive, Hugh Wood. As far as I know, his piano concerto is the one work this evening which has no connection with water. It was first heard 21 years ago during the BBC Proms, and in his 80th birthday year, it returns to the Albert Hall with the same soloist who was the concerto's original inspiration, Joanna McGregor. But if we end with Debussy in Eastbourne, we also begin at the seaside, to be precise, in the northern Italian Mediterranean resort of Alassio. Elgar had gone there to escape the worst of the English winter and finish his first symphony. But although he and his wife loved the old town, the weather was rubbish, cold, wet and stormy. Only when the sun came out did his creative imagination catch fire, not with the symphony, but a piece to capture his impressions of one beautiful afternoon in the Vale of Andorra. Elgar noted he went for a walk among streams, flowers, hills, the distant snow mountains in one direction, the blue Mediterranean in the other. I was by the side of an old Roman road. A peasant shepherd stood by an old ruin, and in a flash it all came to me. The conflict of armies in that very spot long ago where now I stood. The contrast of the ruin and the shepherd. In that time I had composed the overture, the rest was merely writing it down. The leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, has already taken her place on the platform here in the hall and tuned the orchestra. And here comes Ryan Wigglesworth. Slow progress, but here he is, coming onto the platform to open tonight's prom by conducting Elgar's concert overture in the south, Alassio.
Thank you.
Elgar doesn't get much more unbuttoned and exuberant than that, does he? His concert overture in the South, Alassio, more like a Straussian tone poem than any kind of overture. Played to open this BBC Prom at the Royal Albert Hall, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ryan Wigginsworth. And the viola soloist in that moonlit serenade passage, brought to his feet immediately, I must say, by Ryan Wigginsworth, was Jørgen Frost. Bad weather in Alassio, troublesome mosquitoes, but Elgar was delirious about Italian cooking. Well, now it's piano move time for a work whose premiere resounded round this hall in 1991, the Piano Concerto by Hugh Wood, who celebrates his 80th birthday this year. He'd actually been asked to compose a viola concerto, but he decided instead to write a piece for one of his ex-composition students at Cambridge, with whom he'd had an instant rapport, Joanna McGregor. I talked to them both at rehearsal this afternoon and started by asking Hugh what his first impression of Joanna was.
I used to await her supervisions eagerly every week to see what she'd be wearing next time, because she was a great pioneer in women's fashions at Cambridge and very unlike the rest of my students, who had no idea of what to dress, but she led in tarpaulin trousers and I think a straw hat once or twice.
No, I don't think it was a straw hat. You've always gone about a blazer.
I walked
around in a purple school blazer that some boyfriend had given me. Which you were very taken with.
And
which was very punk at the time, if you
yes,
remember.
Yes, of course.
Okay, well, and it's only fair to say, Joanna, what was your first impression of Hugh?
Well, Hugh's reputation was quite fierce. You know, he was, yes. He could be quite robust if you didn't know anything.
I like that word.
I remember having to recite, this is how fierce you were. We were embarking on string quartet writing. And you said, right, tell me now, every Beethoven string quartet that he wrote, chronologically, opus numbers and the keys.
Good heavens, was it?
And you know what? I could just about do it. I'd mucked up on it because I knew you were going to say something like that. It was real old school education, actually.
But you must have detected quite quickly that I was bluffing too.
I think this. Well, it was obviously a sparky and enjoyable relationship, yes. Right from the start. When you wrote the concerto, is it true that you wrote it to reflect both her technique and her personality?
Well, yes, I suppose so, in a way.
And if it's a portrait of you, how much do you find playing it? It's a portrait of him. can you hear Hugh in it as you're playing?
Well, the first thing Hugh said to me today when he came and found me in my dressing room and I was clunking away, you know, playing slowly some of the harder passages, and he said straight away, I can't believe I wrote this piece. I can't believe I wrote this, because I think it has got a lot of notes and it's highly virtuoso piece, and so in a way I think Hugh feels it's not a regular piece of his, but I think it very much falls into the other concertos you've written, because it's big symphonic writing, and that's what you really hear at the beginning of the concerto and again in the slow movement, which is essentially orchestral variations with beautiful decorative passages on the piano, and then this fabulous cadenza, of course, in the middle of the slow movement. But I hope Hugh won't be offended if I say it's a highly romantic concerto, even when it's at its most serial, you know, and at its most highly structured at times. And the material is used over and over again. You know, all the material comes back in the last movement. All that, those minimalist sounding rhythms and chords and everything, it's all the same material from the opening condenser of the piano, you know, in the first movement. And of course, the thing is, it takes me ages to cotton onto this, you know. I mean, this is the thing about excavating into a piece, you know, you get everything on the top surface the first time round, and then you just keep on going down and down and down. And then when you come back, you keep on going, oh, okay, so this is doing this chord again. So I think it's a very interesting example of the way a composer has a series of chord patterns in their head, and they can fashion a 30-minute piece out of it.
Joanna McGregor and Hugh Wood. Well, the stage is sorted, the orchestra tuned, the heave-ho has been given. And now here come Joanna McGregor and Ryan Wigglesworth joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales on the platform to perform Hugh Wood's Piano Concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
Exuberance at the end of Hugh Wood's Piano Concerto, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall as part of tonight's BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, by Joanna McGregor with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ryan Wigglesworth. I say live, but I must apologise for the technical problems during the concerto. We lost you completely for 30 seconds or so, I gather. 5 minutes of the standby disc, that was all in the first movement, back here for the remaining two movements. Joanna McGregor and Ryan Wigglesworth at the front of the platform. Huge embrace between the two at the end. Not surprising, Ryan Wigglesworth learnt that in just a couple of days. And coming down the steps now, the man himself, Hugh Wood. Schoenberg at its most austere at the beginning, cool late night jazz in the slow movement, Nat King Cole's Sweet Lorraine, a little bit of everything in the finale. Hugh Wood says the eclecticism of the whole is down to his chaotic mind. I'd say it was more like fertile, inquiring, bright-eyed and slightly wicked. And he described Joanna's comments about the concerto, which you may have heard before it, as the most perceptive and the nicest things anyone's ever said about it. Back on the platform, Hugh Wood and Joanna McGregor. And Ryan Wigglesworth joins him. Hugh Wood in white, Ryan Wigglesworth in black. Hugh Wood thanking everybody. He says he's enjoying his 80th birthday at the moment. Last thing he wrote was a ballad for Joanna McGregor to play at this year's Bath Festival. Hugh Wood, Joanna McGregor, Ryan Wigglesworth at the front of the platform here in the Albert Hall. She's got a very busy summer, but said she still found time to go swimming this week at Brighton. She wouldn't miss that. Beethoven and Shostakovich at the Guiting Power Festival in the Cotswolds at the end of the week. On tour with the National Youth Orchestra, of course, playing Messiaen's Turangalila Symphony, and she'll end up with them back here at the BBC Proms. Kick-started Hugh Wood's career, the Proms, really, 1965, his Scenes from Comus, demonstrating that blend of qualities which Joanna McGregor talks about finding in his music. Highly structured, very emotional. Well, the Royal Albert Hall is certainly less of a cauldron on hot summer nights than it was before its renovation, but nonetheless, I think people will be glad to get outside for a breath of fresh air and, of course, always an ogle at the always magnificent and gleaming Albert Memorial across the road in Hyde Park. After the interval, we'll be heading for a distinctly French-coloured ocean, ending with Debussy's summing up of the sea in all its moods in his La Mer. We begin with Ravel's Boat on the Ocean in the composer's own orchestration before indulging into Henry Wood's full-fat, full-colour version of Debussy's Piano Etude, evoking the legend of the submerged cathedral of Ys, La Cathédrale Engloutie. So, what could be more appropriate for the next 20 minutes, with that music to be played by a Welsh orchestra, than to hear from poet and historian Phil Carradice, who's been investigating the legend of a lost realm submerged beneath the waves of Cardigan Bay.
I'm standing on the beach at Aberystwyth. Now, it's a wild and windswept place, even on the best of days. Today certainly isn't one of the best of days. It's overcast, it's raining, the tide is in, the waves are crashing on the beach. But on a clear day, if you look north, you can see the Llyn Peninsula and the mountains of Snowdonia. If you look south, you can see as far down as Carmarthenshire, even as far as Pembrokeshire. It's a wonderful view, a fine view. But what lies beneath this huge stretch of water? Flood myths are found around the world. But what interests me here is our own version, which I believe may hold a key to our past and to our cultural identity. It's not hard to imagine land beneath the waves, and for many centuries this lost, sunken realm with its 16 cities has had a name, Cantre'r Gwaelod.
Cantre'r Gwaelod, or the Bottom Hundred, is a legendary land which lies just beyond Aberystwyth, under Cardigan Bay.
Folklorist Dr. Juliet Wood.
The story is that at a time a man named Gwyddno Garan here was king of this area, and it was a very big area. And he had a seneschal, a servant basically, named Saithenin. And because it was the bottom 100, a low-lying 100, it was ringed in by a dike. And Cythinin one night left the sluice gates open and the land was drowned. And one of the stories says that Cythinin was drunk.
The sigh of Gwyddno Garanhir was once common parlance in Welsh. The king, impotently watching the sea invade his palace, his orchards and his pastures. An attractive story, but is it unique to Wales?
The closest parallel is actually the story of Caer Is in Brittany. And Caer Is has much the same story, and indeed some of the same characters. The Cythenin character is there as well. And there, the woman seems to be more prominent, because you have this idea that she fell in love with someone, and in one version, it's actually the devil who tempts her, and she allows the water in. In this one, the suspicion is she's left a well uncapped, and the well overflows, and she attempts to escape on the back of a horse, the father's horse, we think. But because she is the one who's guilty, she has to fall off the horse, and only one person can escape. Now, if you look at all of these together, there are certain common features that they have. And you try to find the oldest version of this. And the oldest version that we can find is in something called the Black Book of Carmarthen.
I've come to the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth to look at one of the cultural treasures of the nation. And amongst many, many priceless manuscripts that the library holds, this book is probably the most celebrated. It holds the key to a largely lost oral culture.
What's on the desk in front of you is a 13th century manuscript known as the Black Book of Carmarthen. You can probably hear the creaking as I open the leaves.
Dr. Meredydd ap Hugh, keeper of manuscripts. The book contains not only the earliest version of this story, but also the earliest references to Arthur and to Merlin.
Largely, we can say that it's a collection of poems written during the 3 centuries preceding the manuscripts writing by this unknown scribe. Now, there are some poems in this manuscript that are obviously the remnants of earlier tales. And I think this is the guise in which Cantred Gwaelod appears in the manuscript as the remains of what would have been probably larger tales. All we have left are these fragments of poems written down during the 13th century in a period, of course, of great upheaval in Welsh history.
Stand forth, Cythenin, and look upon the fury of the sea. It has covered my Gwyddno. Accursed be the maiden who released it after the feast, the fountain cupbearer of the raging sea.
This may be the oldest text, but it's hardly the clearest. The language is archaic, the orthography is ambiguous. As to the narrative, it's a little like trying to reconstruct an entire opera from the scraps of a single aria.
Boyd, emendigaid y forwyn a'i hellyngawdd wedi cwyn.
Dylan Foster Evans is a senior lecturer in medieval Welsh literature at Cardiff University. I'm hoping he can explain what this enigmatic poem tells us about the myth of the sunken city.
The speaker is calling on this character, Cythenin, to come out, to stand forth, and to look on the sea which has covered my Gwyddno. The land has obviously been swallowed up by the sea, but we don't get a description as such of that. That's sort of in the background, that's already happened, right, in a way. But as soon as we get that reference to him, the focus of the poem switches to a maiden, Morwyn you say in Welsh. She's called Meredydd, which is the Welsh equivalent to Margaret, and it appears to be her fault that the waters have come in. What exactly did she do to cause this? And why, we're not entirely clear, but there seems to be a sense of guilt regarding her act.
Accursed be the maiden who released it after the feast, the fountain cupbearer of the raging sea. The cry of Meredydd from the battlements of the fortress today, even to God it is uttered, usual after presumption is utter loss. The cry of Meredydd from the back of the bay horse, It was a mighty and generous God who did it. Usual after excess is want.
I find it quite interesting that, you know, when I was told the legend back in the 1950s in school, the gatekeeper was very clearly a drunken lout who overindulged and fell asleep in his cups. And that was the reason. No mention of Mererid. It was Scythenin, the gatekeeper, the problem. Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting metamorphosis away from this poem to the modern story. And the modern story is very different. It's definitely about a very rich land called Cantre'r Gwaelod, the Lowland Hundred. In some versions, the land is seen as being rather decadent. They're party people. They don't behave according to the highest moral standards. And Seithenyn is a gatekeeper charged with the floodgates, making sure that the tide does not inundate the land. Of course, he joins in the partying, and the land is devastated, and most drown, some flee and escape to higher land. Now, then, where does that drunkenness come from? It's certainly not in the early poem, although we can look at the early poem and there's the odd hint there, maybe. There's a word, gwynai, which is used to describe a horse, actually, in the early poem. But it's very close to the Welsh word for gwyn, which is wine. And we certainly know that the poem was mistranslated at various times. Now, did that lead on to a later idea of a drunken Seithenyn?
By the early 1800s, Seithenyn was deemed one of the three principal drunkards of ancient Britain. And the idea of drunken debauchery is taken even further in one of the most important Welsh publications of the 19th century.
What I think popularised it was Isaac Folk's version in his book Cymru Fu, Bygone Wales, which was published a century and a half ago this year, a very influential work. And the first story in that book is Cantre'r Gwaelod. And there you can see very clearly that Seithenyn is being held up as a warning and as a figure who would, who gives a great boost to the temperance movement.
The original poet draws a different moral conclusion. Pride comes before a fall, repentance follows presumption. And the stanzas leave us with strange images of a maiden shrieking, of water gushing out from a fountain or a well, and a bay mare galloping across the waves. We can only make sense of these ideas by looking at wider oral traditions. Juliet Wood.
One of the essential sort of episodes in this story is a well, and a woman is in charge of the well, and she forgets to put the cap on the well. Now, we know that there's an Irish version of this, which is very interesting, because the woman is called Boan, and she looks into a well that she's not supposed to look into, and the water bubbles out of the well, and she's eventually drowned, and she becomes the Boyne River. So the Boyne River was originally a woman. And there's something very mythological about this. But most of the stories are actually attached to geography, to actual elements in the environment. This is very powerful in culture to make the environment in which we live very meaningful. And these wonderful legends really travel from place to place.
But there's a similar story then, which is found up in the Conwy area, linked in part with Gwyddno, also linked with another king called Helig. So there are various kinds of stories like this around Wales, and you can imagine them being related to explain geographical features. And in particular, if we're looking at Cantre'r Gwaelod and Cardigan Bay, I mean, there are two things there which even today feed the imagination in this direction. When the tide goes out on some of the beaches in this area, you will see peat cuttings sometimes, and occasionally as well, tree stumps. But you can see then how the imagination would say, well, there used to be a forest here. And the other thing, of course, are the causeways called Sarnai in Welsh. They're the sort of shingle reefs that reach out miles into the sea.
We've come now to a spot on the coast just north of Aberystwyth. Here you find one of the real oddities of Cardigan Bay, one of the so-called sarns that appear, well, just like jetties or old causeways. Now, to me, they look distinctively man-made. But lecturer in physical geography at Aberystwyth, Dr. Howell Griffiths, is here with me today to correct that impression. So, are they man-made, Howell?
All the evidence points to the fact that they would be lateral moraines. So they would be deposits carried to their present position and deposited there by the Welsh Valley glaciers during the last glacial maximum around 18,000 years ago.
Well, this particular one here, Sarn Cynfelyn, is named after an old British hero. How does that tie in with the legend of Cantre'r Gwaelod?
Well, I think how this Sarn and the others in Carrigan Bay have been interpreted as causeways or the tops of the flood defences that used to protect the kingdom of Cantre Gwaelod from the floods.
I mean, OK, it's a folk story, but was there ever anything here?
If you look at the most recent data, it seems to suggest that about 6,000 years ago, when there was a fenland forest growing on the what are now beaches here, the sea level would have been about between 2 to 4 metres lower than at present.
So it's quite conceivable then that that land was farmed, was cultivated and was inhabited?
Certainly, it's certainly possible. It would have been a very fertile plain. It's possible that they would have passed on some knowledge that sea levels were gradually rising and that they would have maybe embellished that into this myth of a sudden submersion of land.
So, does the story explain the landscape? Or does the landscape explain the story? In 1748, a respectable navigation chart soberly notes the site of King Gwyddno's palace at the very end of Sarn Cynfelyn, just north of Aberystwyth. Nobody now believes that, so I wonder, are there even rocks to be found out there? At Aberystwyth Harbour, I meet ecologist Phil Hughes, a skipper of 30 years' experience and president of Friends of Cardigan Bay. They've been diving in these waters since the 1980s.
Bear in mind, occasionally in Cardigan Bay, we get very, very clear days in the water. Certainly, you know, you can see some quite sort of square and angular boulders out there, which are glacial, and could have perhaps looked as if they were stones from a house or something. Of course, it's very, very shallow out there.
How shallow?
Well, chart datum is charted about 1.5 metres at the shallowest.
So you couldn't stand then, presumably, out there?
Well, some of the tales I've heard many, many years ago in our present day said that people have stood out there. I've been fortunate enough to work out here for over 30 years and I haven't, and probably wouldn't even try and attempt it. It's a long way offshore out there. It's about 7 miles out.
So, Cantre Gwaelod, is it a myth?
Well, I think it's more than likely. If people were around back in Neolithic times, that there were people walking around out there, maybe people forming the first sort of shelter out there with animals, a little bit of tree clearance. And I think it's probably tales of that were handed down, that there were people out there.
Certainly the discovery of a human footprint offshore in April this year lends further credence to the legend. But for me, the story of Cantre Gwaelod, the Lower Hundred, embodies other, perhaps more important truths. The sea can be a very threatening power, particularly on wild and wind-blown days like this. In some respects, it's something of a metaphor for invasion, for a people losing something significant. And the legend of Cantre Gwaelod is all about losing.
So many people looking at this would say it is a Celtic myth. And certainly when Debussy did La Cathédrale Engloutie, he had a Breton parallel. Villemarqué, the great poet of Breton identity, had told this story. And interestingly, we know that Villemarqué had actually seen the Black Book of Carmarthen. So he might have been sort of, shall we say, developing his Breton one. So it becomes this wonderful kind of cultural myth of this Celtic world, which was great in the past and has this wonderful heritage, but this heritage has somehow been inundated. If you live on coastal areas where the coast changes quite dramatically, it's not surprising that you take these stories and you kind of turn them into this kind of legend. But you do find it quite a lot in Welsh, the idea that the inundation will occur. I mean, the death of Llywelyn, the last king of Wales, the poet sort of says, and now the sea has taken over the land. I mean, you know, what could be worse?
There is a long tradition of seeing that the flood as a metaphor for a threat against the Welsh language and its culture. I was brought up within sight and smell and sound of the sea. And in Wales, and especially in Welsh, of course, you do have poems regarding these events. So there's one in particular that most Welsh speakers would be familiar with by J.J. Williams, a poem to Cantre'r Gwaelod, O dan y môr a'i donau, mae llawer dinas los. Under the sea and its waves, there's many a fine city. And it's a poem by a man looking back at his youth, which was spent in Cardiganshire, and he claims to have been able to hear on a quiet day when there were no waves, when there's no wind, you could hear the bells of these lost cities chiming away under the sea.
I mean, that's the version that we have today, isn't it? You know, the bells of the lost cities, the 16 cities, and even actually seeing buildings on a calm day underneath the sea, listening to the bells. That's the version we get.
Yes, and it's a very resonant version for modern Wales as well, because J.J. Williams, from Cardiganshire, but he moved, like countless thousands, from rural Wales down to work in the mining valleys and the coal mines of South Wales. So the poem can be read, in a way, as a sense of longing for that rural background.
So where did the myth come from? The landscape of a crumbling coastline, the ever-changing rise and fall of the tide, the foaming white horses on the tips of the waves of Cardigan Bay. Or maybe it's the fantastic vision of a poetic nation of storytellers. But for me, the legend of Cantre'r Gwaelod is all about loss, the underlying sense that Wales is but a remnant of something that was once bigger and greater, and that, like the shores of Cardigan Bay, our very language and culture face inundation.
We're becoming more and more aware that we may lose things as a result of climate change, possibly as a result of our own negligence. So I think it does do us good to look back at some of these cultural attitudes to the changing environment.
And of course we like to think that, you know, disaster is coming but we're going to avert it. Or we're going to be the one who escapes. We're going to be the one on the horse. Obviously we're not going to be the ones who are drowned.
As a poet, it's perhaps inevitable that I should have attempted to catch the magic of the legend of Cantre'r Gwaelod, the Lower Hundred. Shimmering at sunset, above the kingdom of the lowland, these waters hide the truth. A people punished for their tardiness, Saithenin of the Locks, insensible and dreaming in his cups, Gwyddno, warrior king of the Old North, bemoaning beautiful Mererid, her ranks of raw admirers. Whichever way, God clearly turned his waters on the land. Listen for the bells, the pealing of lost iron, a sea surges through clerestories, swamps the sluices of Saithenin. Listen for Mererid's cry, knowing the disaster she has wrought. Gwyddno's wail of anguish, echoing like a call to prayer across the canyons of advancing waves, lamenting all the glory of his Lower Hundred. Look for the remnants of the 16 cities, the walls and towers of inundation that shimmer here each evening, the kingdom of the lowland.
Poet and historian Phil Carradice on the lost land of Cantre'r Gwaelod. The Sunken City was produced in Cardiff by Jeff Ballinger. Not quite so well timed as usual from the Promenaders, the usual collection, of course, for musical tragedies, doing as well as it always does. Well, if you were listening to the Hugh Wood Concerto before the interval, you'll be well aware of the technical problems. And if you'd care to listen to the repeat at 2 o'clock next Thursday afternoon, the 2nd of August, all will be well, all will be as we heard it here in the hall. And welcome back to a pretty sweltering Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, in the second part of the first of tonight's two proms, both live, of course, here on Radio 3. This one's been given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and this second part is brimming with French mood music about the sea. The 150th anniversary of Debussy's birth this year is being celebrated throughout the proms, tonight by his archetypal seascape La Mer, and by Sir Henry Wood's luxurious orchestration of La Cathédrale Engloutie, the submerged cathedral. And the orchestra this evening was to have been conducted by its outgoing principal conductor, Thierry Fischer, but he's suffering from a dislocated jaw following the orchestra's return from a highly successful tour of China. So the baton's been taken over at very short notice by composer and conductor Ryan Wigglesworth. And I asked him before rehearsal this afternoon what, as a composer himself, particularly grabs him about the music of Ravel and Debussy.
What always strikes me is that they're often lumped together, but yet they're poles apart psychologically and simply the way the music works. Very often with Ravel, this piece especially in Bach, and I would say it's probably true of Daphnis, that wonderful masterpiece, but if you take it apart, there's sort of nothing there. I mean, there's hardly any material. And to account for its beauty and simply the how it works is very difficult indeed. You try and pin it down and it escapes you. The Debussy La Mer, well, what can one say about it other than it's a complete miracle? I find it very interesting, actually, having this programme with the Elgar and La Mer as bookends. I mean, they were written at exactly the same time, around 1904. And although one would think that they too are very far apart, in their way they are doing, I think, striving for something quite similar, because the Elgar is constantly existing in this shadowy no man's land. And of course Debussy is a master in examining and traversing the shadows, those areas that not many other people have gotten close to.
How does he do that? How indeed, we'll find out later on. But now BBC National Orchestra of Wales begin with Ravel's Une Barque sur l'Océan. Boat on the Ocean began life as one of his miroirs for piano, music so evocative and textured. It's no surprise he orchestrated it a couple of years later. Ravel was then deeply hurt when his orchestral realisation was greeted after its premiere as a confusing kaleidoscope. But for me, the vastly increased instrumental palette just makes the piece even more of an impressionistic mood picture of the sea, full of washes of colour. Back on the platform comes Ryan Wigglesworth to conduct the BBC National Orchestra Wales in Ravel's Une Barque sur l'Océan.
Thank you.
Ravel's In a Bach sur l'Océan, performed to open the second half of this BBC prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3 by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ryan Wigglesworth. If musical impressionism is like painting, then this is like a Monet. Momentary impressions, flashes of light. Ravel withdrew the piece. It wasn't performed in his lifetime after the very first performance, and finally published in 1950. One of the reasons he did withdraw it was because it was compared unfavourably with Debussy's La Mer, composed at the same time. We'll be able to make that comparison in about 10 minutes' time, but first we go underwater for another orchestral transcription. When Debussy's first book of preludes for piano was premiered in 1910, Ravel was hugely impressed by them all, but he had particular praise for La Cathédrale Engloutie, the submerged cathedral, which evokes the Breton legend of the Cathedral of Ys, which sank into the sea to punish the city's impious inhabitants. Sometimes, says the legend, it still rises from the waves, with bells ringing and monks chanting as a reminder to the locals. The preludes were heard here in London in that same year, a few months after Henry Wood had prepared the Queen's Hall Orchestra for Debussy to conduct. The two men got along extremely well. It seems likely that Wood's orchestration of the Cathédrale Engloutie for the first post-First World War prom season was meant as a tribute to the composer who died the previous year. Now, Wood didn't do anything by halves when it came to orchestration, so gong, bells, harps and organ are all part of his rich sound world here. Very full platform all evening, really, here at the Albert Hall, but it's building up, shall we say. Here is Ryan Wigglesworth once more returning to the stage to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Henry Wood's orchestration of Debussy's Submerged Cathedral. The cathedral sinks back beneath the waves. Debussy's piano prelude, La Cathédrale engloutie, in a no-holds-barred orchestration by Henry Wood, performed in the Royal Albert Hall live on Radio 3 as part of tonight's first BBC Prom by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ryan Wigglesworth. Not heard at the proms since Henry Wood conducted it in 1922. Debussy began work on his three symphonic sketches, La Mer, while on summer holiday in 1903, and claimed later, "You'll tell me that the vineyards of Burgundy aren't exactly washed by the sea, but I have innumerable memories. That, in my opinion, is worth more than a reality whose charms usually weigh too heavily on one's thoughts." Debussy's biographer Edward Lochspeiser wrote, "La Mer is certainly the first great impressionist work in music, though its underlying ideas and range of expression are more closely associated with Turner than with the impressionist painters themselves." Interesting, then, that just as Turner had had himself lashed to the mast of a small boat so he could observe a violent storm, Debussy made a dramatically stormy voyage off the north coast of Brittany in a fishing boat, insisting it went ahead despite the skipper's reluctance. The circumstances do seem to have been genuinely life-threatening, but Debussy said of it now, "Here's a type of passionate feeling I have not before experienced. Danger. It is not unpleasant. One is alive." Well, Debussy gave subtitles to each of the symphonic sketches, From Dawn to Midday on the Sea, is followed by Play of the Waves, full of the shifting play of light on water. There's not a lot that's playful, though, in the final Dialogue of the Wind and the Sea, as the approaching storm bears down on the upward thrusting waves. And back once again, Ryan Wigglesworth, joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to conduct Debussy's three symphonic sketches, La Mer. Thank you.
Thank you.
symphony and seascape in one. Sound World, placing the listener on the sea, if not in it. The BBC's Lamaire, played to end tonight's first BBC prom by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield, conducted by Ryan Wigglesworth, making his debut with the orchestra. It took Debussy 2 years to complete. During its completion, he left his wife Lily, went away with Emma Bardac, wife of a respected Paris banker. Took him some time to sort himself out. Despite beginning La Mer in Burgundy, he did finally complete the orchestration of La Mer at the seaside, staying at the Grand Hotel Innsbruck. Back comes Ryan Wigglesworth, a real spring in his step now, as he's got that under his belt. All that music in just 6 days. Shaking hands with the leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, pointing to the heavy brass. Philippe Chartres, principal trumpet, magnificent job. Now Ryan's off down to the Centenarian Festival in Cornwall for 2 weeks. And of course that was founded by the late Richard Hickox, a past principal conductor of tonight's orchestra, the horn section being brought to their feet. He'll be conducting there and playing Schubert for four hands with Ian Burnside. And he's writing a new piece to be first performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra on Britain's 100th birthday next year at Aldeburgh. All the wind. Fantastic performance by them this evening. They'll be making their late night way back down the M4 to Cardiff and starting work on Saturday for their next prom, an all 20th century British musical celebration. Vaughan Williams, Delius, a choral rarity by John Ireland, and a choral classic that fits the Royal Albert Hall like a glove, William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. That's on Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall at 10 tonight for more iconic French music. But for now, an hour or so's breather back in the quieter atmosphere of Broadcasting House. We're waiting to be your host, one James Jolly. James.
Thank you very much, Martin. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And we'll be returning to the Royal Albert Hall at 10:15 this evening for our next prom. And talking of late evening proms...
The BBC World Roots Academy Late Night Prom.
At the age of 13, I decided to play the accordion because I saw this master on the accordion that came from Colombia. First time I saw that accordion, that sound, wow, I really want to play that now.
20-year-old Colombian accordion player José Hernando Noguera and friends perform the traditional music of his Latin American heritage. The World Roots Academy Late Night Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 on Tuesday night at 10:15.
Trust me, they all danced it.
Now, Saturday afternoon's Proms matinee features Les 24 Violons du Roi, conducted by Sir Roger Norrington, a mixed programme of French Baroque music. Well, one composer who doesn't feature on the programme is Jean-Philippe Rameau. So, to make amends, here's part of a suite of his incidental music to Les Paladins. The late Gustav Leonhardt conducts the orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Five movements from Rameau's suite Les Paladins. Gustav Leonhardt conducted the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. And there's more music from the French Baroque on Saturday afternoon, live from Cadogan Hall at 3 o'clock. Music by Lully, Desmarais, Marais, Compre and Lalande, when Sir Roger Norrington conducts Les 24 Violons du Roi. That's Saturday's prom matinee here on BBC Radio 3. Now the third of our four-part series this week on the American Civil War. Historian Adam Smith explores the continuing resonances of the war in the age of Obama in The American Civil War, 150 years on.
Join me at this moment in history and welcome Barack Obama.
On one hand, it was just extremely cold, but it was also very, very exciting. There was just a lot of excitement in the air that day.
On the 10th of February 2007, Senator Barack Obama came here to the city of Springfield in the American Midwest to launch his run for president.
Specifically, he came here to the old state capitol. It's a rather grand building with a classical portico and a dome and an American flag flying off the top. And he came here for a very specific reason.
In the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a house divided to stand together, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for president of the United States of America.
Miserably cold. So a lot of us were sort of crowded onto the lawn around the old state capitol, literally just freezing.
On the steps of the capitol, I met up with Matt Dietrich of the city newspaper, the State Journal Register, who was there that day.
And why did Barack Obama choose to come here? His home base is Chicago. Why did he come to Springfield to launch that presidential bid?
The imagery of the old state capitol is immense. That is the building where Lincoln in 1858 gave his House Divided speech. That speech really put Lincoln on the national map. And Barack Obama, I think, wanted to capture some of that imagery. He really was trying to tap into this feeling that we were a country that was divided in a whole lot of ways. I really think he wanted to get that connection between the critical time when Lincoln ascended to the presidency and what he would be pursuing in the year and a half to come.
As he told his cheering supporters, this was the building where in 1858 Abraham Lincoln made a legendary speech preaching unity over division. As I've been exploring in this series, those divisions over slavery and the relationship between the federal government and the states were at the heart of 4 years of civil war. But what about America in the age of President Obama? He knew that evocation of Lincoln and his appeal for unity would still resonate. But today, under the surface of American politics, are the divisions of the Civil War still visible?
The American Civil War remains a dividing line, not only between North and South, but between certain political factions within the right itself.
Lincoln was portrayed as a kind of a tyrannical figure by his most extreme opponents, who was imposing oppression, basically, on the South.
The South remains a conservative region, very Christian region. The North, as it was 150, even 200 years ago, is far more progressive, imperial, and has become increasingly anti-Christian.
And the most extreme opponents of Obama today would say that he is similarly tyrannical in trying to impose health care.
I don't think a 19th century American, North or South, could have imagined how far the American political climate could have declined towards an all-powerful central federal government.
President Obama's desire to associate himself with Lincoln suggests that 150 years after it began, the Civil War retains currency in American life. And as the reaction to Obama suggests, it still has the power to generate controversy. Why is that so? And how deep do the divisions go? To find out, I travelled south into the old Confederacy, to the city that was once its capital, Richmond, Virginia.
I'm on the banks of the
James River in Richmond. I'm sitting on a bronze bench next to a statue, a near life-size statue, I think, of Abraham Lincoln. And on the other side of Lincoln, there's a statue of his son, Tad, about 12 years old. Lincoln's got his arm round him. The statue commemorates Lincoln's visit and Tad's visit to the defeated Confederate capital at the end of the Civil War. It was meant to be a mission of reconciliation. But when the proposal to put this statue here was announced, it generated an outbreak of protest among some in this part of the world, particularly from a group called the Sons of Confederate Veterans. The Lincoln scholar Alan Gelzo was there.
This statue of Lincoln was to commemorate Lincoln's visit to Richmond at the very end of the war, a visit in which Lincoln was at pains to express the need for reconciliation, kindness, mercy. And as the ceremonies dedicating the statue proceeded, over top flew an airplane trailing a banner, and the banner read, "Sic Semper Tyrannis."
Sic Semper Tyrannis, thus always to tyrants. That's what John Wilkes Booth, a fanatical supporter of the Confederacy, is supposed to have shouted after assassinating Lincoln in 1865. Few today would try to defend slavery or even want to break up the United States. Yet even so, for some, the idea of the Confederacy still has emotional and political potency. The group that protested at the unveiling of the Lincoln statue in Richmond, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, is a major player in what is often described as the neo-Confederate movement.
There is a small but vocal neo-Confederate intelligentsia. These are writers and intellectuals who write pamphlets and essays and articles defending the cause of the South in the Civil War.
Michael Lind, fifth-generation Texan and co-founder of Washington's New America Foundation.
Their basic claim is that slavery was not the real issue in the Civil War. It was the tariff, a protectionist policy that Northern manufacturers wanted to use in order to promote industry in the United States. It's essentially rewriting history to remove slavery and race from the history, both of the Civil War and the American South. But it has a great deal of appeal, particularly among white Southerners, you know, whose ancestors took part in the Civil War and who want to be proud of their predecessors. Growing up in the South, I heard countless people say, oh, you know, the Civil War was not really about slavery, it was about the tariff. That's not the case, but this is a comforting myth that is part of this neo-Confederate ideology, and it remains current in American politics because debates about government intervention in the economy, such as the tariff, issues in trade to this day, are central to American politics. And so by defining the Civil War in terms of economic issues, rather than in terms of slavery, which nobody defends at this point, the neo-Confederates can claim that the Confederacy was the ancestor of today's free market libertarians and champions of local self-determination.
In February this year, a couple of thousand people gathered in Montgomery, Alabama, to commemorate the inauguration, just before the start of the Civil War, of the Confederate President Jefferson Davis. The event was replete with ranks of reenactors in period uniforms, with gun salutes and speeches, songs and prayers. But for these people, the Confederacy represents not just a historical episode, but a frame of mind and a political project about resistance to Washington that is as relevant now as it's ever been.
Good afternoon, my fellow Americans. And happy birthday, Confederates. How wonderful it is to see so many of you here.
This is Chuck McMichael, a past commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which organized the event.
150 years ago, it is meet and right that we should do so, for those events are important.
They are the same dividing lines that have always been there. You go back to the time of the American Revolution, when they were writing the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. You had those like Hamilton, who wished for a strong national federal state, and you had those like Jefferson, who were for states' rights and local control and limited federal government. And in many ways, every political topic and discussion since then has kind of fallen on those two lines. In the 1860s, it broke out into war, actual shooting war, and all throughout American history. And now you see more of a political war over certain issues between federal programs and the rights of states to run their own programs. So I think the issue resonates because it's a fundamental American issue since the beginning of the country.
The fact is that a northern plutocracy of rich industrialists, financiers, and expansionists knew that the loss of the South would cut off their cash cow of raw materials and easy tax revenues.
Today, this commemoration reminds us and our fellow citizens of the enterprise undertaken in 1861.
Chris Sullivan, another past commander of the SCV.
To establish the southern states as an independent nation and to resist the centralized governmental tyranny of the American Empire, which obviously has grown repeatedly out of control.
What they did here 150 years ago are acts that are quintessentially American, based upon the bedrock principles of American political thought. This is why these events should and must be marked, remembered, commemorated, extolled, and celebrated. We proclaim them worthy, that they are resonant to the modern world.
This is a vision of the Confederacy as a proud expression of an American tradition of freedom. There are two problems with this. First, in practice, the Confederacy was very willing to violate states' rights in its all-out defense of a slave society. And second, in order to celebrate the Confederacy in this way, its defenders have to try to push the elephant, slavery, out of the room. Chuck Rand, adjutant of the SCV, insists that slavery is overemphasized. But Bernard Simelton of the Alabama branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People is not convinced.
If you talk about states' rights, it's about southern states' rights to continue slavery, you know, back during the 1860s. And celebrating in this way, need to look at it from a different perspective, you know, also look at it from the African-American perspective as to, is this something that the nation as a whole would like to celebrate, like to commemorate in that fashion?
Our detractors like to talk about it all the time, about slavery. So we don't necessarily find it necessary to follow their lead. I'm not going to tell you slavery didn't exist. Of course it did. I'm not going to tell you that it wasn't an issue. Of course it was. But it was only one of many issues, and we're not going to allow people to paint our history in that with that single stroke, because it does a terrible disservice to the history itself and the people that lived it then, and it really does a disservice to the people today who need to understand these events. You know, I have a master's degree in history, and one of the things you learn is that, you know, the multiple causation for many events, you know. So I think if you try to paint it only with the brush of slavery, you're really simplifying it to a point that does it no justice.
This is an original officer's saber here, and then officers with the bullion.
One of the reenactors was dressed in a painstakingly accurate infantryman's uniform of the 16th Georgia, Company F. He was very concerned to tackle this issue head-on and had gone to the trouble of producing a leaflet for concerned African-Americans.
We extend a handshake to our African-American brothers and sisters. We consider all people to be our brothers and sisters in the same human family with the same father, Adam, and the same mother, Eve. We are brothers and sisters in the American family, sharing the same American life and heritage. We reenact because it had been such a profound impact on our Southern families. This is what we want to explore and honor through living history. Our ancestors went as soldiers to defend the rights of Southern states. Among these rights, sadly, one was slavery, and it was the main concern to slave owners. None of our American ancestors owned a slave, just like 95% of all of the Southern soldiers. Some of our ancestors died in Northern prisons. Slavery was not a part of our personal family's experience and has no part in our living history reenactment. We're handing out to any African-American brothers and sisters around the area, and I've handed out just a few, because I think they were kind of watching the march some earlier. There are not too many of them around here. I've handed a few, though. One was right in the middle of the crowd.
Honoring Confederate history without offending 21st century racial sensibilities is a difficult, perhaps impossible, balancing act, as the governor of Virginia discovered. Richmond, Virginia was once the capital of the Confederacy. Today it's a very different place with a prosperous and self-confident feel about it. But the issues of the Civil War still hang heavy here. Last April, proclaiming Confederate History Month, Republican Governor Robert McDonnell failed to mention slavery.
Governor McDonnell issued a statement commemorating Confederate History Month and actually deleted language that previous governors had inserted about the centrality of slavery.
The reaction to the governor's proclamation revealed just how far racial politics has shifted since the centennial commemorations of the Civil War 50 years ago. The Civil War historian Ed Ayers is president of the University of Richmond.
People on his staff have told me they realize now what a terrible idea that was. I've heard him give an eloquent apology for it himself. But it immediately unleashed criticism from every corner and, most damaging, ridicule on the Jon Stewart Show and Stephen Colbert, popular shows here in the States that are faux news shows. They just ridiculed us. And that's the one thing you can't really withstand. So I know that the governor's looking for opportunities to show, and he immediately issued a mea culpa and a profuse apology and acknowledgement of the centrality of slavery. But that's all it took for the country to say, well, I guess the South's not really changed at all. Then you've had the secession ball in Charleston. You've had the reenactment of Jefferson Davis's inauguration in Montgomery. And in all these ways, all it does is suggest that we've not learned anything in the 50 years since the centennial. We have, but the public discourse can still be distorted by the smallest false move. In the case of Governor McDonnell, it was not a small move, but it was, they even recognize now, a terrible political mistake that did real damage to our state, and I think he's looking to heal that now.
How would you sum up the significance of that episode in terms of, if we're thinking about the prominence of neo-Confederates?
I think that they were important in persuading the governor that this was an important thing to do. But here in Richmond, since then, we are engaged in a citywide effort called the Future of Richmond's Past to show that you can tell the full story. And we've renamed the sesquicentennial. It's the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and Emancipation. Last year, thousands of people circulated throughout the city, and you found more African Americans going to places that are coded white, like the Museum of the Confederacy, than ever before. And the whole point is to show that you can tell the story whole.
When he apologized, Governor McDonnell said that 150 years is long enough for Virginia to fight the Civil War. This April, Virginians were invited to mark not Confederate History Month, but Civil War in Virginia Month. Chuck McMichael of the Sons of Confederate Veterans was not impressed.
Originally, he signed a proclamation, then he came back and changed it. You know, our organization is like any other. You're going to have a variety of opinion among members. You know, officially, we thank the governor for having a Confederate History Month proclamation. Personally, I don't think it was necessary for him to go back and change it, but he's a politician, and politicians, you know, kind of do what they think they're supposed to do.
Active groups like the Sons of Confederate Veterans only have a limited following. Yet many more share what might loosely be called neo-Confederate ideals, a desire to honour the memory of ancestors who died for the South, the insistence that the war was not about slavery, but a defence of home by a Christian people. Once, these views were mainstream. In the early 20th century, the myth of the Lost Cause and its romanticisation of the Old South exerted a powerful attraction to white Northerners as well as white Southerners. The historian Gary Gallagher explains.
They scrambled to find a meaning for the war for their own posterity, and that's the Lost Cause understanding of the war. But I don't think it's one that really carries the day through the lives of the Civil War generation. I think it became more powerful in the 20th century, and it was given a tremendous boost by the two most influential films relating to the Civil War by far that have ever been produced, and that's Birth of a Nation in 1915 and Gone with the Wind in 1939. Those are both ardently pro-Confederate, pro-South, pro-lost cause interpretations of the war. They were controversial, each of them, in their own time, especially Birth of a Nation, but they, I think they had a tremendous impact on how Americans thought about the war.
50 years ago, their Confederate heritage was a source of pride for the defenders of segregation. Back then, a reenactment of the inauguration of Jefferson Davis in Montgomery attracted 50,000 people. The centennial that began with the White South in its pomp celebrating the creation of the Confederacy was transformed into a conflict over the meaning of the Civil War.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
In August 1963, Martin Luther King came right here to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to deliver his famous I Have a Dream speech. And early on in that speech, he says that 100 years ago, the great emancipator in whose shadow he stood declared the slaves to be free. And 100 years later, in 1963, King said, "We are still not free." What King was doing there was very important. He was claiming Lincoln for the civil rights movement.
God Almighty, we are free at last.
Ever since the Civil Rights Revolution, in documentaries, in textbooks, in academic studies, American historians have endorsed the view that the Civil War was about slavery. But as the historian Ed Ayres explains, the idea that it was about something else is astonishingly resilient.
In the folk memory of many people, the Civil War was about states' rights. And three-fourths of white Southerners didn't own slaves, so they could not have been fighting to protect it. I'm just telling you the arguments I always hear when I'm out talking all over the country.
When you say folk memory, I mean, how widespread would you say that interpretation of the Civil War is?
No, it's extremely widespread.
More in the South than in the North?
I would think so, but, you know, I've lectured all around the country, and in almost every crowd, somebody will ask or state that the war was really about states' rights and not about slavery. Now, the people who say that aren't racist. Sometimes they're skeptical of the national state. Sometimes they see themselves as realist. It was really about economics, is the saying that people will use, by which they mean that it was the industrial North wanting to have its tariffs and taxes, and the white South fought back. In all of these ways, I think the people who do this imagine that they are accounting for evidence that the wishful thinking school, as they see it, of the anti-slavery interpretation are ignoring. See, and if you wanted to defend that, you could point out, well, it's true that less than 5% of white Northerners would have identified themselves as abolitionist in 1860. And all you have to do is look at the sorry history of Reconstruction to say, see, that couldn't have been a war to end slavery because they betrayed it and resisted it. Now, the White South basically has no advocates in academic history. And I think what people have been trying to show is, well, just to say that you did not own a slave does not mean that you were not fighting to create a new nation based on slavery. That you're fighting not for an economic interest, but for what you see as a new nation that is going to be honestly based on slavery and on white supremacy. So, you know, that's the reason, I think, to begin with the idea of complexity, rather than just adding it in a kind of begrudging way.
This folk memory, as Ed Ayres calls it, needs to be reckoned with. You don't have to go very far in the South to find people who feel some connection to Confederate history through their ancestry and who want to recognize and honor that. Like their parents and grandparents, many in the South today insist that the Confederacy stood for fundamental American values and that its legacy is an important part of the American story. In a cemetery in Charlottesville, I talked to the historian Gary Gallagher of the University of Virginia.
We're here in the University Cemetery, this corner of which includes more than 1,000 dead Confederate soldiers. 13 years ago, there were virtually no individual headstones in this cemetery. And the dead were buried here without headstones. But there has been this sort of neo-Confederate resurgence that has come into places like this and placed individual headstones where there were none before. There aren't 1,000 plus headstones here. There are, I would guess, I don't know, maybe 100 or 100 and some Confederate headstones here, the number that's increased rapidly over the last few years. The Texans seem to be in the forefront here of marking their dead. We have George Benjamin right here to our left, right next to the monument from the 5th Texas Infantry.
What's gone on in the last 10 years that
Well, I think that there's a feeling on the part of many people with Confederate ancestors that the American culture is moving too stridently against them, and they feel that their ancestors are demonized.
So they've just taken the names from that were inscribed
from the
here.
Hospital rolls. Yes, right. And they have, yes, and so there are stones for a number of these names now, but is George Benjamin, Private George Benjamin of the 5th Texas Infantry actually right there? No, he's here somewhere.
And nearby, at Appomattox, the place where the Confederacy surrendered, I talked to one visitor who expressed the complicated feelings of many white Southerners.
We're from North Carolina, so this is our first time being here, and I'm really awed by it. Just think it's awesome.
What is, you're from North Carolina, and how's the Civil War remembered, and what do you remember from high school? And
well, just being a rebel, more or less, being from the South and being proud of it, and I had a lot of grandparents that fought in the Civil War, so it means a lot down there.
Is this a sad place for you to come? I mean, this is the place where they... Confederate
sure, we surrendered here, but I think we united as well. In my opinion, we surrendered and united. We had to. We're not sore losers.
you think about your great grandparents, whoever they were. You know, what when you think about them now, what do you think? What were they fighting for?
They were fighting for their freedom. I think. I mean, the freedom that we had down south. We didn't want anybody to take us over, just like they didn't want anybody to take their government over up here. We were fighting for our rights. We were big in the Bible, and we stood fast to what we believed in. And I can't say slavery. I did not agree with that, but that had a lot to do with it, I'm sure. You know, that's one of the biggest questions about the war, in my opinion.
For 100 years after Appomattox, there was violent conflict over the question of whether African Americans, the descendants of slaves, were equal citizens. Now there's an African American in the White House, and that issue is no longer at the forefront of national politics. But the image of plucky Confederate rebels standing up to an overbearing government still resonates. If one legacy of the Civil War was a stronger central government, another was an enduring hatred and distrust of that government.
So we're standing in Northern Virginia, right on the banks of the Potomac River. Above us is the home of one of the main losers in that war, General Robert E. Lee. Who was.
So we asked Robert McCartney of the Washington Post to take a walk from south to north, from Virginia into the federal capital, Washington, to show how this history is written into the fabric of the city. And to set out how America is still refighting some of the arguments, if not the battles, of the Civil War.
Well, there's a real struggle right now, again, between states' rights and idealized states' rights and federal control. The Tea Party, a lot of the Tea Party supporters, the conservatives, especially in the Republican Party, believe, for instance, that the new health care law is an unconstitutional abridgment of states' rights and of individual liberties. And they're saying that the federal government is running amok today by having this health care law, national health care law, just as the conservatives said 150 years ago, that the federal government was running amok by threatening to interfere with the institution of slavery. So these
you could argue that the Civil War has more resonance for the Tea Party's rhetoric about centralizing government tyranny than the American Revolution does.
Michael Lind, political analyst and Texan exile in Washington.
In the last generation, the American Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, which used to have its geographic base in the Northeast and the Midwest and the West Coast, is now dominated by the American South. And as a consequence of that, a lot of traditional Southern ideas associated with conservative Democrats about the tyranny of Abraham Lincoln, about the importance of states' rights, and even debates about whether the Civil War was really about slavery or the high tariff, have come to define American conservatism and the right wing of the Republican Party.
So now we're approaching the southern end of the Memorial Bridge, and the actual border between Virginia on one side and the District of Columbia on the other. This is the northernmost edge of the Confederacy. It's important to think that the Tea Party, you know, and the conservatives in the country are not only in the South in the United States, but they are more heavily represented in the southern states, in the states that were in the Confederacy, than elsewhere in the country. Because to a large extent, the political lines drawn within the United States geographically still correspond to a remarkable degree with the political lines back in the 150 years ago when the Civil War was fought. If you look at the map of which states voted for Obama versus which states voted against him, it overlaps pretty well. You know, you've still got the sort of north-south, very much sort of a north-south division, at least in the eastern part of the country. And
in the last 50 years, as conservative Republicans have supplanted conservative Democrats as the dominant political force in the South, something else has happened. Money and power has shifted west and south. The Sun Belt, the old Confederacy plus the Southwest, provided every elected president from Lyndon Johnson to George W. Bush. So this is a complicated story. Neo-Confederates might feel more marginalized, but the South as a region has never been more influential at any time since the Civil War.
One legacy of the South's defeat was suspicion of the federal government. Economic policies, you know, regulation of workers' rights, regulation of the environmental protections, regulation of consumer safety. These are mostly imposed by Washington at the national level, and they're seen in the sort of more anti-regulatory, more free enterprise-oriented parts of the country as being another kind of economic autocracy, if you will.
One of the guiding lights of the radical right-wing Tea Party movement that has become such a power in the Republican Party is the conservative political commentator Glenn Beck.
Another recent rally here at the Lincoln Memorial was staged by Glenn Beck, and he had a rally here on the anniversary of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech. It was a rally of conservatives. I went to the rally and interviewed a lot of the participants, and I heard a number of people say that they felt as though the kinds of things that, well, certainly that the revolutionary generation fought for, but also to some extent, to a lesser extent, but to some extent, that the Confederacy fought for, that those were values that were important to preserve today, and that is resistance to authority, resistance to centralized government.
So a certain idea of the Confederacy reinforces the Tea Party's case against big government. But at the same time, Tea Partiers embrace the equal rights tradition, Martin Luther King's interpretation of Lincoln's legacy. That other heir apparent to Lincoln and King, President Obama, is, however, seen in a much more hostile fashion, echoing the rhetoric of the Civil War. Michael Lind.
Many critics of the Obama administration, like many critics of the Lincoln administration, accuse it of trying to create a consolidated central government that will obliterate state and local governments and impose statist tyranny on the United States. In the name of socialism now, this was called consolidation in the 19th century, this fear that you would have a centralizing tyranny that would abolish the Constitution.
So now we're walking up the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Well, I think that Lincoln's message of conciliation is still an inspiration to people who would try to overcome the divisions within the society. President Obama, you know, who's trying to be a conciliator, he's not seen that way certainly by his opponents. It's seen as mushy sometimes and even weak-willed by some of his critics, but I think that that is a part of that sort of tradition from Lincoln is part of what is inspiring Obama, at least in his attempts, at least the way he sees what he's trying to do.
We're standing right now outside the two proscenium boxes on stage left of Ford's theater. We're at the spot where John Wilkes Booth, on the night of April 14th, 1865, moved slowly but surely down a very crowded lane of seated spectators, making his way to this door where the President of the United States, footman...
For some historians and commentators, the Civil War at the very least provides a worrying precedent for the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that has been raging through American politics in recent years. At Ford's Theatre, where Lincoln was assassinated, Lincoln scholar Alan Gelzo walked us through this cataclysmic moment of political violence.
Stepping in, placing a .41 caliber Derringer pistol behind Lincoln's left ear and pulling the trigger, Booth leapt over the rail, jumped down to the stage 12 feet below, turns to the audience and shouts, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants."
When I've written about the Civil War and you go back and see how it came about, it comes about because of language.
Historian Ed Ayres.
People talk themselves into the Civil War. They draw lines in the sand. You step over this and, oh wait, you just did, okay? And our language became very binary. And what you see is that white Northerners say things about the white South that are not based in reality. And white Southerners say things about the white North that are not based in reality, but there is no independent press. There is nowhere to read anything that's not saturated in political partisanship. What I worry about is that's where we're returning today. There was a time when I was growing up, you know, when at least the three big networks sounded impartial.
The word tyrant comes very easily to American lips. I mean, we were founded as a nation on the accusation that the King of England was a tyrant. And whenever political leaders in American political history have resorted to unpopular means, surely someone who is in the opposition is going to find a very easy way to the T word. It's become used, I'm afraid, a lot more in recent times as the internet, as the disappearance of journalistic civility in American politics has given permission to people to use the most violent sorts of rhetoric about American politics, probably more violent than I think has been heard in American politics since the Civil War. People have talked today about the unpopularity of certain measures, such as President Obama's health care proposals, and they have used the T word to describe him. They have talked about nullification, individual states, in other words, by their state legislative action, declaring that certain federal statutes are non-operative within their borders, or even secession. In the state of Idaho, for instance, the Idaho legislature had talked very recently about nullifying the federal health care legislation. And in Texas, the governor of Texas, and this is all more the significant for the fact that Texas was part of the Confederacy, the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, has talked about secession. I don't know that the governor of Texas was terribly serious about that, but the very fact that the word would even be used, it's so loaded with historical explosive that it is unsettling to hear these kinds of recommended actions. At that point, I want to ask people, what are you going to get if you try to nullify federal laws? John Quincy Adams, who was the sixth president of the United States, said that nullification is really nothing but practical civil war.
In January this year, America was shocked by the shooting of Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. This prompted renewed soul-searching about whether violent political language can incite real violence. Michael Lind.
Well, the United States is an extremely violent country. The last decade or so actually has been one of the rare, relatively peaceful periods with a low level of political violence in the United States. So that this country is a continent with a tradition of armed insurrection and paramilitary political violence, and particularly in the South, where the Ku Klux Klan operated for decades as the paramilitary death squad wing of the Democratic Party in what was effectively a one-party banana republic. So I, for one, am not sanguine about the prospects for the United States escaping a return to levels of political violence of the kind that we've seen in the past. It may not take the same forms. So there is a culture of violence, particularly among Scots-Irish Southerners, a group to which I belong. The coals are always ready to be fanned into flame when political tensions get too high.
To sit here in Ford's Theater and reflect on the Giffords shooting, on other attempts at assassination of public officials, violence threatened to public officials from all political quarters, to sit here and reflect on that is to get a kind of wake-up call. It's to be reminded, this kind of rhetoric exacts a price.
Nothing like living in the 19th century to make today seem less dangerous, though. I think there's a lot of hot air, a lot of huffing and puffing, a lot of bluffing. I don't see us on the eve of any great cataclysm on all this. Americans like to believe that we are in order to generate people going to the polls, but I just don't think that Social Security is something people are going to die for.
Ed Ayres' note of caution is important. Today, there is no division anything like as fundamental as slavery. What's more, the South itself is changing. This may be the last time a significant Civil War anniversary strikes a chord at all. Michael Lind.
Back in the 1980s, I was in a Texas courthouse with a Mexican-American fellow citizen, and at each end of the hall was a separate drinking fountain. And of course, back in the days of segregation, one was the white drinking fountain, the other was the colored drinking fountain. And so my Mexican-Texan friend looked at me and said, "Which one did we use?" And that kind of illustrates the demographic transformation of Texas. Right now, Texas has a non-white majority when you combine the Latino population and the African-American population. And the white minority increasingly is made up of whites from other states and, in some cases, from other countries.
Traveling around the South from one city to another, from one hotel to another, you can't help but notice that this is no longer a society made up just of black people and white people. Today, the American South is clearly a very different kind of society from what it was 50 years ago at the time of the centennial of the Civil War in the 1960s. The 2010 census showed that in the first decade of the 21st century, the number of Hispanic people in the Carolinas, in Kentucky, in Tennessee, in Alabama, in Mississippi, and in Arkansas doubled in just one decade. And at the same time, as the population and the economic center of gravity of the United States shifts ever westwards and southwards, the proportion of white Southerners who can meaningfully trace their ancestry back to the Confederacy is getting ever smaller.
In the 21st century, when you have a dwindling minority of white Texans and white Southerners are descendants of Confederate soldiers, I think that the impulse to defend the Confederacy will simply become extinct after a while. What will survive will be the Jeffersonian traditions of states' rights and libertarianism that the Confederates themselves shared.
So perhaps the Civil War is relaxing its grip on America. But as long as its people disagree over fundamental questions of government and freedom, it will continue to keep them in its hold. It will be a long time before Americans can entirely escape their Civil War.
The American Civil War 150 years on was presented by Adam Smith and produced by Phil Tinline. Tomorrow evening, at the later time of 10 o'clock, crime writer Louise Welsh explores the Civil War battle for British hearts, minds and wallets through the lens of the Glasgow experience.
The 2012 BBC Proms. On Radio 3, the BBC Proms cycle of Beethoven's symphonies reaches its climax. As all eyes turn to London for the opening of the 2012 Olympic Games, Daniel Barenboim conducts the Ninth Symphony, a vision of hope, reconciliation, and hard-won triumph. The last of nine symphonies that changed music forever. Beethoven's Ninth, conducted by Barenboim at the BBC Proms. Tomorrow night at 6:30 on Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Coming up at 11:45, Fiona Torkington introduces tonight's Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Tom Service with a second of this evening's proms.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for this late night prom. I'm Tom Service, and we're live here on BBC Radio 3. Now, as if it weren't enough for the players of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra to play a complete cycle of Beethoven's nine symphonies and quite a lot of the music of Pierre Boulez too, they're also playing this concert of chamber music tonight. Now, we're going to hear two pieces, both of which predate any of the Beethoven symphonies we've been hearing since last Friday, or indeed any of the music by Pierre Boulez too. Beethoven's Quintet for Piano and Wind in E-flat major, and Boulez's Le Marteau sans Maître for alto soloist and six instrumental players. Now, that piece is really one of the dazzling masterpieces of the post-war period, still one of the most influential pieces of the last 60 years. And I'll be talking to its conductor, François-Xavier Roth, and the alto soloist, Hilary Summers, on stage here before that performance. However, we start with Beethoven. Now, this quintet for piano and wind was written when Beethoven was in his mid-20s, and as we've been hearing all week, it's another piece where Beethoven pushes the boundaries and makes this apparently intimate combination of just five instruments really expand into a great sense of sonic and expressive scale. Its three movements are based quite clearly on a piece that Mozart wrote for the same combination and in the same key too, of E-flat major. And although this piece isn't a kind of musical revolution a la Eroica, it's still Beethoven at his brightest and breeziest. Now, you're going to hear five players from the West Eastern Divan Orchestra: the oboist, Ramon Ortega, clarinetist, Shirley Brill, horn player, Sharon Polyak, bassoonist, Zeynep Kulyolo, and pianist, Bishari Haruni. So please welcome them on stage now, here on the Royal Albert Hall, to play Beethoven's Quintet for Piano and Wind in E-flat major, opus 16.